So what I'll be discussing are searching strategies, and thus the title is meant to indicate they will be inspired by living beings and by biology. Now, in the applications that I will discuss today, you will see there are no very complex and complicated networks. We'll be searching on regular lattice, but as you will see, the strategies are very general, so they can be employed on complex networks as well, and that's why I'm telling you these searching strategies in this story today. So let's start by looking at what we are, the natural phenomenon that we are trying to understand. What we are trying to understand is the behavior and the searching capabilities of birds and insects, and they're pretty spectacular in this in these capabilities. So let's see, this is a typical experiment that entomologists will do. They have a source of odors or pheromones in this case here. The male is starting from here, and as you can see from this scale, we are talking about hundreds or several thousands of meters. So the male is starting here, the emission is here, and this distance is pretty considerable compared to the size of the body. And what it does is that it starts, so the arrows here are the local directions of wind. Now this is a typical pattern of the way the male moth would get to the source. And as entomologists have defined two characteristic patterns, zigzagging and casting. So casting are, for example, these phases here where there is wind blowing this way, and there's a very extended crosswind span of the trajectory. On the other hand, there are zigzagging. Zigzagging is this phase here where the wind blowing this way, and the moth is going upwind by a great amount. So this is a typical pattern. The other thing to be known is the fact that moths are able to estimate the local direction of wind. They do this by looking at the ground and measuring the speed at which the ground is changing, the panorama on the ground is changing. So this is the kind of things that we want to understand, and clearly the search is a very complicated search that they're doing because they're starting really far away. Now, to understand even better the kind of challenge that this is posing, it's important also to remark that this is not just for entomologists, not just for understanding living beings. In fact, there are important technological applications of this kind of stuff. And this is one of the applications, for example, for sniffers. So robots that are able to sense odors, in general odors, they don't need to be odors, they might be any molecule that they are able to sense. And once they receive these molecules, out of these detections, they are able to locate the source of this Now, the kind of applications that people have in mind is, for example, for the detection of chemical leaks. Imagine you have a leak somewhere and you want to detect it at an early stage. That's, for example, something you would like to employ. The same for drugs. And even more clearly, there's an application for mines, because mines, they need some particular and characteristic particles. So if you were able to send by a robot to be able to track from these particles where the source is located, you would be able to send a robot to demine a field rather than sending a human being, and that's really advantageous, and you can clearly see that there's motivation for that. So now, to understand the kind of problems that physical problems that living beings have to face, it's interesting to compare, to look at the general problem. General problem is that, as I was saying, you have a source, for example, of odors of molecules. They are emitted and they are transported in the atmosphere. And the task for the living being is to locate from those molecules the source. So that's the general problem. Of course, the problem is in these generalities is universal, but in fact there are many differences depending on the type of transport. Once you emit these particles, it's very important, and the problem changes a lot, whether depending on the emission rate and the type of transport in the medium that you have. And there are two big classes that you can distinguish. On one side, the microorganism, and on the other side, the macroorganism that I was mentioning before. So in the case, and the big difference is made by the size. So talking, this is E. coli, it's a bacterium, and these are the flagella by which it's moving. Now the size of this bacterium is 1 micron. And this is another, this is Dictyostelium, which is a eukaryotic unicellular organism, which is also the model organism for chemotaxis. And these are these are staining for the receptors. So what, the way they move is that they receive these molecules via these receptors, and then, as I will discuss in a second, they regulate the rotation sense of the flagella, and that's the way they move. Now, the big difference between this case and this case is made by the size. So here we're talking about 1 micron. So if you think in terms of a moving particle, the typical, and they move about 20 microns per second. So if you look at this scale, which can be somehow considered as the mean free path of the of this particle, living particle, the typical fields on that scale are smooth. So somehow gradients exist at that scale. They're well defined, and that's the way, as I will indicate in a second, that's the way bacteria move. Now, if you look at the situation here, that's completely different, because once the molecules, in this case it's fluorescein just for staining, are emitted from here, as you can see, since the medium is very random, there's turbulence out there, there's wind in the air, what happens is that the patch here is completely broken up. And when you are down here, as it was the case before, you don't see anything. And when something is coming, certainly the gradient of this is not pointing to the source. So that's the big difference between the two cases. In the case of bacteria, it's a very noisy world because they live in the microscopic world. So there will be a lot of noise in the form, for example, that bacteria are not able to go straight. If they try to go straight, after 4 or 5 seconds, they will deviate by about 60 degrees. So they are unable to keep a straight course. That's the kind of noise that they have to face. While in the microscopic case, the kind of noise that one has to face is that there's no gradient to be traced. So there's no way, for example, if you were to optimize a function, you could do gradient climbing. So let's see what bacteria can do and how they climb these gradients here. So this is this case of E. coli. And what they do is the following. That's a typical trajectory of E. coli. And the way they climb gradients is very simple. Imagine you is moving in a certain direction. And now what it does is that it makes a convolution. So let's say that the molecules it's receiving at time t, time s. What it does is that via some biochemical processes, it makes sort of a convolution of the number of molecules detected in a certain time. And the convolution kernel is made this way. So as you can see, if the number of molecules is going, and this is zero area, the sum, the area of this and this is equal to, it's the same. So this one has zero integral. So if this quantity is going up in the recent past, as you can see, this quantity is positive. This quantity is positive, what it will do is that when it goes, it reduces the frequency of tumbling. From time to time, bacteria, they tumble, and they rotate, and they restart in another direction. Now, if this quantity is positive, the frequency of tumbling is reduced. So it keeps going straight for a longer time. While if this quantity is negative or is zero, it tumbles at the fixed frequency, at the fixed time tau. So essentially, when it's going uphill, it turns less, it keeps the course longer, and when it's going badly, it turns at a fixed rate. So that's the way you produce a mean, you produce a flow, and that's the way you can climb gradients. Now there are some details, there's a difference depending on the size of the cell, whether you sense temporal gradients like this way, or Dictyostelium, what it does, it senses gradients on the size of the cell. So spatial gradients are sensed. But that's minor differences. The important point is that this strategy is a gradient climbing strategy. So that's what you would do if you were to do an optimization of a function by gradient descent or gradient ascent. That's precisely the kind of things that, that a bacterium is doing, except that, of course, it's very complicated because there's a lot of noise. Now, the important point that I want to stress is that, yeah, don't need the black. The important point is that there are gradients. So underlying this process, there are gradients, and the fact that there are gradients is due to the fact that they live, they have a very small size of the order of microns. So let's now estimate how strong the concentration should be. That's the way, in fact, we started all this work. The way we started all this work was to ask, so you've seen what bacteria do and the way they climb gradients. So now imagine that the concentration of your field goes down, down and down, up to the point that there's no gradient anymore. You just to feel particles. You start to feel really the particle nature of the molecules that you're detecting. So there's no gradient anymore. It's just kind of noise. And can they still do something? Because this is the problem. Imagine that it goes down, there's no gradient. So what kind of strategy you could employ to search for the source of these molecules? Now, this argument here that I will discuss in a second is meant to show you that this problem in the world of bacteria is a very special problem. In the sense that to get to the point that bacteria sense individual molecules, you really have to go down in concentration. You have to descend to picomolars. And then you might wonder if there's a source of nutrients that emits picomolars, why should it go after this source of picomolars? It's not a very good source. There's no nutrient over there. So in fact, there's just one example, as I will show in the sequel, where there's a bacterium, there's unicellular, that is responding to picomolars. So in general, this problem doesn't exist, quote unquote, in the microscopic world. But in the macroscopic world of birds and insects, that's a very generic problem, and that's how we got to the problem of birds and to the problem of insects. So that's more or less the story. So let's see now the argument of how the concentration scales with the integration time. So that's a very classical argument. This is a beautiful paper by Bernie Russell on 77 that is trying to estimate the number, the constraints, the physical constraints on the measurement of concentration for bacteria. So the argument is very simple. You take the good old argument of Smoluchowski. You have a diffusion-limited process. So you have these molecules that are diffusing in the medium. Diffusivity is D. And the size of the bacterium is A. It's a sphere, that doesn't really matter. The fact that it's a sphere is just a 4 pi. And this is the rate of detections that the bacterium is measuring. And this is the concentration at that location. So that's the classical argument of Smoluchowski. You get this in two lines by putting Fields condition at infinity and measuring the rate of a diffusion equation. And that's what you get for the rate. Now, if you want to measure concentration, of course, this is a rate, so you need to integrate, because it's a noisy process, you need to integrate this for a while, for a certain time, for an integration time. And the game is to understand how this time should scale with the concentration. So the idea is that detections you should have, that the signal-to-noise ratio, this is the average number of molecules that are detected, should be much larger than the fluctuations. And since this is a Poissonian process, the standard deviation is the square root of the average. So that's the kind of relation that you get. Out of this, what you should retain is that there's C of R times T of integration. So if you want to measure a very low concentration, the integration time scales like one of the inverse, one over the concentration. So if the concentration is very low, the integration time must be very large. And if you want to measure gradients, it's even worse, because this one would become TQ. So this one would become TQ. So it would scale even worse. So the bottom line is that if you want to do chemotaxis and you want to measure gradients reliably, well, you better have a pretty large concentration. And if the concentration goes down exponentially, you should wait an exponentially long time. Otherwise, you will not be able to measure gradients and concentration. So let's see what birds do. And what birds do is that they respond on time of milliseconds. So certainly this is not what birds and insects do. If you expose a moth to pheromones, it will respond in milliseconds, and there's no way you can measure a gradient in case.
What are the concentrations of the birds? Are they picomolars or
more? No, they're much larger when they arrive. See, the problem is that they don't detect continuous, there's no concentration field. This is precisely this figure here. As you can see, the concentration field is completely broken up in patches. So you don't really detect, you detect in a very intermittent way. From time to time, there's a patch coming, and then you don't measure anything for a long while, and then there's a patch coming again. And so it's a very sporadic and intermittent detection problem. But when you receive a lot, because there's a patch arriving. The problem is that the patch, if you measure the internal gradient of the patch, it's not pointing to the source. So you cannot measure a local gradient and use this to go. At least if you are far away. Of course, if you're here, you're very close to the source. Then you can do that. You can just swim in the jumping boat and go. So this is the problem. And the problem, so why am I showing all this? Well, the reason is that somehow, if moths are able to do this, it means somehow that this is feasible. Okay? It sounds like a very, yes?
So are they always able to find the source?
Pardon?
Are they always able to find the source? Or
that's a very good question. They sometimes they get lost. So it's not the unit. It's not that it always works, but you know they are able well enough to do this to survive because that's the way they mate. So that's the way the species is surviving. So certainly it's something that it's very extremely strong selection in evolution because that's clearly the way they mate. So. That's why biomimesis is interesting because somehow evolution had a long time to evolve all this. So somehow if they managed to get solutions that somehow thinking hard we wouldn't be able to get. So what I retain from this is that even though the problem looked like impossible because we are starting far away, we are detecting very few molecules in a sporadic way, still they make it. So somehow we should also be able to make it. And the problem will be to understand how we can make this kind of searches. So that's the problem. And now, I was talking about sniffers. The existing sniffers, since it's not clear what birds and moths are doing, they try to rely on biomimetic again strategies, but they rely on microorganisms, on the chemotaxis that you've seen before. So what the existing sniffers, the existing robots do, is that they try to climb gradients. Gradients are not there, but they try to do it. Despite of this, they try to do it. And of course the problem will be that, as I've tried to explain, that you can do these kind of things just in dense conditions when there's a lot of molecules close to the source. But this is not something you can do when you're far away. So that's a prototype of existing sniffers. So sniffers, there are some sensors here. There's a processor here that is doing the computations. And then there's there are wheels. And the e-noses, that's where you detect molecules. So there are some sensors that detect the number of molecules got in a certain time. And that's the way then they try to move. This object is a... Well, the other day we were discussing, because we are in the process of now putting the strategy that you will see on a robot. Now, if you order it from, it was ordered a couple of years ago, it was 15,000. That's not bad. I think you can do it much less. For example, we were talking about just taking you know, what you use for kids. And rather than putting the processor on the robot, just sending the signals wireless and then having a computer calculate and then via this moving the robot again. Now, so you can do something for less, but if you...
How many of them do you need to put together?
Right, okay, so now the point is, do you want to do a collective strategy of search or you want to do a single strategy of search? Now, again, let's be ambitious. We've seen that moths are able to do that, and they certainly want to be the first to get there because they have to mate. So they don't want to do a swarm. So they must be able to do individually. So let's try to make an individual search strategy. So that will be the game. The game will be to try to do that and individually. Of course, it's much harder to do it individually than by swarming. Okay. So you can take what I will tell you as a strategy, and you can do a swarming as swarm of searches.
It's
the difference between an e-nose and a sniffer?
Okay, e-nose, it's a different sensitivity. E-nose,
so there's another sensor?
Yeah.
So there's four sensors?
Yes, exactly. And they try to be left and right for the same reasons as we have the tuna in the nose. You're better able to see where it comes from. Like there was a nice experiment published a few weeks ago where they just closed one of the nostrils and they saw that we are much less able to move if we close one because we can really get the sense of where the molecules are coming from. So it's useful to have the two because it's able to detect the direction in space. So as I was telling you, the existing strategies, all existing strategies, they rely on chemotaxis. So that's the kind of things they can do. This is not more than 3 meters, and as you can see, it's pretty strong smoke coming from out here. So in this case, it would be able to get here, but if you were to move the robot 10 meters down, it would be lost. It wouldn't be able to do this anymore. It would wait for an hour and not be able to get the gradients. As I've shown you, the gradients, they scale, the integration time scales exponentially, so this is going down exponentially. So at 10 meters, you would wait for an hour and don't move. Okay, so that's the problem. I hope I convinced you that it's an interesting problem, so let's see what we can do. And so the problem will be to devise these individual search strategies far away from the source in dilute conditions. And this is what we have done in collaboration with Emmanuel Villermo in Marseille and Boris Schreiber at KITP in Santa Barbara. So just to see you the kind of, I will get into the details of the strategy, but if, yes?
Why does the concentration go down exponentially?
Why the concentration is going down exponentially?
Yeah.
Because there's mixing in the atmosphere. So it's a chaotic system, it has a positively atmospheric exponent, so the concentration goes down exponentially. You can have other cases, it might be a power law. But unless you make very special thing, it will go down pretty fast from the source. Right? So there will be mixing, and so the concentration will go down. Now, exponential was just a case of figure. It might be a power law. And in that case, you would be slightly better off. But still, I mean, you would have a problem. If you go sufficiently far away, the concentration will still go to zero and decay pretty fast. Okay, so this is the kind of patterns of search that we get. So this is our simulations. The robot, simulated robot started from here. As you can see, dots here represent detections. So for a long while, it's going around in the desert. And what it does, as you can see, is something which is very reminiscent of casting and zigzagging of the robots. So casting here, and then it will detect something, it goes upwind. And then when it starts getting into the good zone, then it starts to detect more and more, and it's doing zigzagging. So the colors here are meant to represent the concentration field, the average concentration field. And the color along the trajectory is just a linear coding in time. Yes?
So it knows the wind?
Right. So the wind can be known pretty easily. Yes, it knows the local wind, as in the case of moths. That's very easy to get in a robot. You just turn on the monitor. Even the mean wind is very you don't need to measure the instantaneous wind, you just measure the mean wind. So you take any anemometer, whatever you ask your dynamicist friend, and they can
just notice one on your robot a slide or two ago.
Pardon?
Where is it on the robot?
Oh, not on this one.
Okay.
It doesn't need wind in this case. You know, there's no wind. I mean, in fact, it's so easy. It does chemotaxis, so it doesn't need wind. Right? But if you were, you could put an anemometer. That would be pretty much this size, so it's not a big deal.
So what is this thing which is that?
Which one?
What is this thing you just pointed to?
Which one?
The middle.
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
The camera.
The what?
The camera.
Looks
okay.
Like your cell phone.
Yes.
What fraction of the time is your strategy doing zigzagging and casting, or is that something that changes adaptively?
It changes adaptively. As you will see, this is something that we don't pre-program. It's something that will come out. In fact, let me tell you in a nutshell what we do, and you will see that nothing is programmed here. So let's give up on tracking concentration. There's no way we can track concentration. That's not what we want to track. So we cannot do it. Let's give up. So the problem is, what else could we track? And what else could we track is something that necessarily must be more abstract because there's no particles to measure. So the idea is the following. It's very simple. We build up, we treat this problem as a decoding problem. We don't know where the source is, and we have some molecules. So we treat these molecules that come, this history, as a message sent in a cable. It's a very bad cable because it's full of noise, but still, let's treat this as a cable. So let's construct the probability field for the location of the source. Okay? And then the point is, how can we exploit this information? And the way we move is that we move in such a way to reduce as fast as possible the expected reduction of entropy. So we want to reduce entropy as fast as possible. That's the strategy, and that's why we called this algorithm infotaxis, because we move according to information. So we try to track information. In chemotaxis, you track the chemical field. In infotaxis, what you try to track is the information acquisition. So you try to move locally in such a way to acquire as much information as you can. Okay, so that's the idea. Let's try to get this done. So as I was saying, this is the source, and it's emitting particles. Now, the robot or the searcher, or whatever it is, it's moving along the trajectory, and from time to time, it's receiving some molecules. Okay? And from this graph, you should retain that there's a long spacing between different detections. Okay? So this is the message that the searcher is receiving. So let's treat this as a message in a random medium, and let's use this trace of other encounters to construct a posterior distribution for the unknown being the location of the source. Okay? So we try to construct, like in a message, you receive the message, there's noise in the cable, so you try to infer, knowing the properties of the cable, you try to guess what the message sent on the other side of the cable was. So we do exactly the same thing here. We construct the posterior probability distribution for the location of the source from the message, which is the story of the detections that we have along the way.
Now, if your smelling source would be on the other side of the wall, and you would sort of do this thing here, you would conclude that the source is somewhere out there, because the smell may not sit on linear lines because of the geometry.
Well, if you were to do this in a room, then you should somehow know from these rates that there's a wall here. So if a molecule is coming, of course, if you give the completely wrong, it's like in a cable. If I give you the completely wrong cable and I ask you to do decoding and I tell you that the cable is one thing and the cable is completely different than that, you would do the wrong decoding.
No, but wouldn't there be sort of some, I mean, not really, if I detect a molecule here,
yes,
and here and here and here, I might still be able to go around if I don't try to predict where the final source will be, but I predict sort of the point on the path of the molecules. You see what I'm saying?
No. So you're saying, let's assume that there's a source in the other room.
Right.
Okay.
So if I would predict the sources at the door, that
but
would
this,
not be bad.
But you should put this into this function that I haven't told you what it is yet, which is the rate function. So the
geometry of your...
That's correct, right? So in this case, I would say you should know that if I receive a molecule here, there's a wall. So you should know that somehow this trajectory can be very convoluted and it can come from the other room. Now, of course, if you don't have this information, well, then you should do more work in learning, for example, first what the room is. Okay? We cannot create a map out of nothing. So somehow you should have a clue of what's the rate of molecule detection at a certain position, conditional to the fact that the sources are not. So in this case, I would say you should somehow have a sense of what's the probability that if the source is in the other room, you might detect the molecule here. Okay. So what's the posterior distribution? Well, the posterior distribution, assuming just for simplicity that detections are a Poissonian process, well, the probability is that you break your times in little delta t. So the probability that you don't detect anything is just exponential of minus delta t. So this is the zero detection in a Poissonian process of average r dt. And if you receive something, then you should also multiply by this. And then you should, so that's Poisson, in case then you should normalize this to be integral over the M naught. Just this is the normalization of the posterior, which is here. And when you normalize this, it drops. And that's the expression. Then you integrate this, so it comes as an integral over the S. And that's the way you get this expression here. Well, these times here are the times of detection that are here. So that's one particular model of Poissonian detections.
And DZ is a double integral.
Pardon?
DZ.
DZ is just the normalization over all the unknown. Yeah, there's a Z, which is the integral over this variable here, in here, you see, Z. So this one would be the likelihood that the source is located at position R naught, and then I normalize over all possible positions in space. So this one integrated over R naught would sum to 1.
Yes. As R of S.
What?
Within the interval as R S.
This one?
Yeah.
So this one is this function here. This is the rate function that tells me the properties of the cable. As a message, you should know what the cable is, so you should know what the noise, what's the probability, the rate of particle detection at a given position, conditional to the fact that the source is somewhere. And then what you do is this R of S is the trajectory of my searcher. So the position at time S.
Yeah, how do you calculate R of R and R naught.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's treated as independent.
Correct. That's why I'm saying it's a Poissonian model. It's one possible model. Then you might have patches, and one of the problems will be, can I make it even though the model is not right? So is the strategy robust with respect to this model? So how can I calculate? Let's just make the simplest possible crude model. I'm just saying that particles, for example, they are transported at velocity v, they diffuse with the diffusivity d, they die with the typical time tau, and they are emitted at the rate r. And I just solved this differential equation. It's a Bessel function in 2-3D. In 2D, it simplifies to this. So that's the expression that you can get for the concentration, and then the rate is equal to this. So that's just one model. This will be model independent. The strategy will not depend on the model. So this is just for the sake of example. It's one particular model. Okay. So the real problem is, I constructed the posterior distribution. What can I do with it? If I were a message, I would do decoding. So I would pick, for example, maximum likelihood or maximum a posteriori. Now, if I do this here, it leads to disaster. Just to disaster. Because initially, you don't know anything. You receive one molecule at the very beginning, so the posterior field is completely flat and it's even biased wrong. So if you do maximum likelihood, you lose the robot, 80-85% of the cases. So that's not what you want to do. What you want to do is to think at the search process not as individual jumps, but think globally. So what you want to do is that you start from a field which is very flat and you want to shrink this field to a delta function. So what you want to do, your global goal, is to start from a large entropy and shrink the entropy to zero. So that's what you want to do. And the way you want to do so, you want to consider the search process as a process of reduction of entropy. Okay? That's what you want. You want to do, in fact, the opposite of what you do in non-equilibrium statistical physics. Once you have a non-equilibrium system in statistical physics, you know that it goes to equilibrium by maximizing the production of entropy. Here, we want to do the opposite. We start from equilibrium, equipartition, flat distribution, and we want to go to as far as equilibrium as we can. So we do the opposite. We maximize the production, the reduction of entropy. Okay, so why is entropy important? Let's see if this idea has any chance of being right. Well, let's do the following. Let's assume that somebody gave me the probability distribution. I'm not constructing the probability. Somebody gave me this probability distribution. So I have n points to visit, and the probability that I get the source at the jth point is given by pj. So if I want to minimize the search time, this is the expression of the search time, and let's consider probability distribution that, of course, are normalized, and then they have a given entropy. And let's see how the search time depends on entropy. Okay? Let's see how strong is the dependence of the search time on entropy. Now, this is the standard calculation that you get, that you do when you do Gibbs, when you do to derive Gibbs with energy level proportional to J. So I don't need to do the calculation. Pj is a Gibbs distribution given by this. Now you stick this in and you compute the relation between T and S, which is given here, and that's what you get. And what you get at the end is that the search time is larger or equal than the exponential of the energy. That makes perfect sense. S is the log of the number of states. So this is telling you that the search time is larger or equal than the effective number of points that you have to search for. Okay, so it makes sense. What is of interest to us is this. Search time is exponential of S. So this is telling you it's not a theorem, it's that we have no bound, no control of optimality, but somehow this is telling you that the search time depends very strongly on entropy. So if you manage to reduce this, you most probably will be able to reduce this. It's not mathematics, it's not theorem, but this gives a high chance that this is a good thing. Now, for those of you in coding, you will remark that usually what you have is something like this. It's not exponential, it's linear. But the point is that our alphabet is a very bad, in the coding sense, alphabet, because the only thing we have is one letter. It's a sequential search. So when you do, for example, coding, what you can do is that you can put zeros and one. And you can, when you do, for example, optimal Huffman coding, you put zeros and one. Here, there's no zeros and one. They're just a sequential search. You visit point one after the other. So it's an alphabet with one letter. And that's why we get this exponential here. OK. So let's see what we can do now. How can we reduce the entropy as fast as we can? So let's assume that we got to a certain position r. We got a certain number of molecules at time t r. And we built up, out of these stories here, we built up a posterior probability distribution the way I told you before. So I'm in r, and now I need to decide whether I want to move up, down, left, right, or I want to stay at the same place. So let's compute the expected variation of entropy upon moving to one of the neighboring points of R. Now, when I do this, I have two possibilities. Either I find my source, and if I find my source, the new entropy will be zero, the old one was S. So this is one. And the probability for this to happen, as far as I can estimate with the, with the probability I have, is Pt of Rj. Okay? Or I don't find the source. If I don't find the source, I can still get zero particles, one particles, two particles, and so on. So I compute for each one of these events, I compute the new entropy, I subtract from the old entropy, and I compute this delta S. And then I estimate the probability, self-consistently, I estimate the probability for this to happen out of the detection model here from the known, from what I know right now. So all this self-consistently, I calculate the average here from what I already know. And this is the expression that I get, okay? And then what I do, well, you can take a stochastic strategy, or you can just pick the Rj that gives the delta S as negative as possible. This will be on average will be negative. So I pick the value Rj, argmax, argmin of this expression, okay? That's what we do. At each location, we build up the posterior probability distribution, we compute is delta S, we pick the move that leads to the minimum of this. And now, for those of you in learning, you will recognize that this is what we are doing, this recipe here, this infotaxis prescription, is precisely doing what they tell you to do when you do learning. When you do learning in a random environment, they tell you, try to mix as best as you can exploitation and exploration. So exploitation would mean try to exploit the information you already have. And exploration would be wander around trying to figure out what the environment is. So that's precisely this. This contribution, forget about this, this drops out the entropy and would lead you to maximum likelihood. It would tell you go to the places where Pt is as large as possible without any sense of the entropy, because this will factorize. This other one, it tells you it doesn't matter if you can find the source or not. Just go to the places where you have pretty much the highest probability of getting particles. This will tell you stay in the same place where you were, because you were, if you detected one particle, most likely that's the place where you will get another one. So don't move from there. So what this prescription is telling you is, to, is a balance, is somehow balancing exploitation and exploration. And that's precisely what the general philosophy of reinforcement learning. So that's the kind of pictures that we get. In this case, we start from here. There's no wing. As you can see, it's spherical symmetry. And what the robot or the searcher does is that it starts to spiral. Of course, it's a lattice, so it's not a perfect spiral. But it starts to spiral, and then the symmetry is broken. And then from a while, as you can see, the symmetry is broken, and it gets into the source. Now, this is these spirals are very reminiscent of the only example you remember I was mentioning of a microorganism doing responding to picomolar. And the only organ, the only unicellular is the sperm of sea urchin. And what it does is that it responds to picomolars. And the way it responds, as you can see here, is by doing spirals. So most probably this is just a symmetry, the same kind of symmetry argument that is playing here. The spiral is the figure that is maximizing the probability to get back to the shore if you're lost in the sea. So that's probably the simple explanation of this kind of pictures. And this I've already explained, there's wind blowing here, and you do the zigzagging and casting that is here. So at least at the level of patterns, we are recovering interesting and useful things. So let's see now how it works really in search times. So let's start the robot many times from a given location, and let's see how fast it traces back the source. So we put in, these are simulations, so we have a concentration field that drops down at 50, so that's the correlation length. And as you can see, that's the scaling that we have for the search time as a function of the distance. As you can see, it's not exponential as it would be for chemotaxis, it's even linear here. Okay? So it's really a big improvement over any existing strategy for this type of problem. And the mean is really representative of what's going on, because as you can see, there's the probability distribution here. It's a function of search time. It's dropping down exponential. So the mean is really representative of the typical case. It's not something coming from two big things. So worst cases are not bad at all, because it's dropping down exponential. So this one I have 5 minutes of this drop. So this is to show that infotaxis is better than other things that you might do. So this is the PDF for infotaxis. This one is the strategy that you would get. It was asked by one of the referees. Forget this and just keep this. So what would happen without exploitation? And as you can see, is at least twice slower, because you lose time at the end. When you can exploit the information that you build, you don't exploit it. You keep exploring, so you clearly go slower. This one is when you just try to maximize the expected number of particles without counting the information. So it's even slower. And this one, the worst of all, is maximum likelihood. Maximum likelihood is a disaster, because this one is the search times, and this is calculated just over the 15% of cases where it really gets the source. In the other 85%, the robot is lost. There's an instability. I will be happy to explain what the instability is. So now the big problem is, we've been doing all this with the model of the medium. So let's see now, if the model of the medium, nobody's going to give me the model of the medium. So the big problem is, given a model of the medium wrong, because it's certainly going to be wrong, is the strategy able to rescue this bad modeling and still get to the source? Okay, so let's be as bad to the robot as we can be. We assume an independent detection model, a Poissonian one, where particles are detected independently. And we put our robot into this kind of flow, where certainly detections are not independent, because they are coming by patches. Okay? And let's see how the robot is able to deal with that. And that's precisely what you see here. Of course, here it gets completely wrong, because it's assuming that these are coming independently while there's a patch. So they are not independent at all. So it starts to spiral around here, because it thinks that the source is here. But still, after a while, the patch passes. And then it starts to enlarge the spiral to restart the wave again, and it gets here in a time that's just 2.5 times longer than what you would do with a model that is taking into account the time correlations here. So
why wouldn't it follow a patch? Maybe it does.
It doesn't follow a patch because there's no, why should it follow a patch? It's trying to locate the source. So wind is blowing this way. So if a patch is coming, the source most probably is here, it's not here, right? But if wind is blowing this way and you get a big patch, the source is here, most probably, not here. So it shouldn't go after.
Oh, so it knows the wind, right?
Again,
yeah,
it
knows the wind.
Knows the wind, yes. Okay, so just to conclude, this idea of building up a map might seem like a complete abstraction, something that will never happen in the brain. In fact, it's not quite so. I will not claim that there are probability maps in the brain, but certainly there are spatial maps in the brain. That's clear, that's proved. This is an old work of in 71 by O'Keefe, where he's showing that in the hippocampus you have place cells that store a map of the environment of the rat. These are experiments on the rat. And even more recently, there's been works on a spatial map in the entorhinal cortex that is sending out messages then to the hippocampus. And just briefly this, they monitor the firing rate of a neuron here. And as you can see, what happens here is that the firing rate goes up whenever the rat is passing through the vertices of a triangular lattice in the room. So the rat is moving in the room. Whenever it passes through the vertices of a triangular lattice, this neuron fires. And different neurons fire with lattices that are always triangular but out of phase. So somehow the big problem is to understand how this triangular lattice and the interference of these triangular lattices can lead to the localization of the rat. But certainly animals, evolved animals, are able to build up maps, so that's not something completely out of the blue. And that's pretty much all I wanted to say. Thanks again to Schreimann and Pierre Mo and to all of you for your attention.